as well. So maybe I can just start by noting that while I'm here presenting the research, this is actually a collaboration that would have been completely impossible without our wonderful local partners. So that's the Centre d'Assistance Médico-Psychosociale, which is a community-based organization in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. And Professor Justin Kabanga has been really incredible Congolese psychiatrist and social worker who's made so much of this possible. So I think it would actually be worth having just a quick note about DRC context again, because it is very specific and very unusual in many ways. So as many of you probably know, there's been fighting in eastern DRC since 1998, when the region was destabilized by violence associated with the Rwandan genocide. The International Crisis Group notes the DRC is the site of one of the world's worst ongoing humanitarian crises, and also the site of the world's largest and most expensive peacekeeping operation. Despite numerous peace agreements, fighting continues in the region, and it is fueled really by a large number of different armed groups who prey on the civilian population. Human Rights Watch has reported sexual violence is nothing less than a weapon of war used by most of the forces involved in the conflict. And a recent study published in JAMA noted that roughly 40% of women and 24% of men have experienced sexual violence related to the conflict. 64% of households report conflict-related human rights abuses, and 50% of the population screened positive for PTSD. So as you know, goes without saying, this is a backdrop of widespread sexual violence and abuse related to the conflict, but also to other, you know, interpersonal dynamics as well. So a little note about the project background. What I'll actually be presenting today is, you know, it has been an interesting experience. The Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, where I work, has a Women in War program, and we've done a lot of work in DRC, basically starting in 2006-2007. And what we've found as we work on issues related to sexual violence against women is that we've been following a bit of a kind of trail of breadcrumbs to start to unpack what is an extraordinarily complex phenomenon. And what we started by doing was what we thought was relatively logical, to ask women about specifically their experiences with conflict-related violence and sexual violence. And as it turned out, that was actually quite inadequate to start understanding this issue. And what the women told us is that, well, you know, it's great that we have a voice and we can talk to you about our problems, but what you really need to do is talk to the men, talk to the service providers, talk to the community leaders, because these are people who have extraordinarily enormous amounts of influence over the way that we experience this issue. So what we found we ended up doing was following kind of a multi-year approach where we did a lot of mixed methods, qualitative and quantitative studies, starting with the women, but then expanding out to look at how different populations thought about and experienced the issue of sexual violence. And we've come to our current project, which is very much ongoing and has been kind of an interesting experience, which is looking at the stigma associated with sexual violence in DRC and how that affects women. Why do we want to look at this issue in particular? What we heard from the women themselves was that sexual violence is destructive not only on an individual level, but on a family and community level as well. And so actually a quote from a man in DRC is that sexual violence is an existential threat to Congo. It's something that destroys our families and destroys our communities. So it's very much perceived as a problem that's far beyond the individual. Stigma absolutely intensifies the negative consequences of rape that women face. And interestingly enough, what we heard from women who'd often undergone extraordinarily traumatic attacks was that stigma can actually be as traumatic as the attack itself and can have, in some ways, longer-term consequences for them. Another thing that we heard, as again I kind of foreshadowed, is that women noted that men are pivotal actors in the way that they experience or do not experience stigma and the way that they recover or do not recover from sexual violence. So, as I mentioned, it was a bit of a process. So in earlier surveys, through clinic-based samples, we found that 29% of sexual violence survivors reported rejection from their families as a result of experiencing conflict-related sexual violence. About 6% reported rejection from their communities. And in previous work, we found that men stated they are also highly traumatized by sexual violence perpetrated against women in their homes. But so just a moment to think about these statistics. So stigma against survivors is an important issue. At its most vicious and extreme, it results in rejection of a woman from her own household, her own family, and sometimes her own community. And since, you know, we're all very involved in these issues, we can recognize that this kind of rejection would then put women on pathways in which they fall into these cycles of vulnerability, violence, transactional sex, et cetera, et cetera. And often when women are rejected, they're rejected with the young children that the other family members wouldn't be able to care for, so they actually have other people, or they have a household that they have to take care of when they leave the home. So to study the question of stigma, we came up with, you know, two research questions that we wanted to think of as relatively logical. If 29% of women experience rejection, 70% don't. So what are the factors that affect men and other family members' decisions to reject or stigmatize survivors? So we not only want to look at vulnerabilities, but also want to investigate some of those resiliencies that might exist. And who, if anyone, are the change makers who can influence the reduction of stigmatization as well? Again, we're trying to take this kind of resiliency approach. So we were in a unique position where we wanted to study this topic. We'd done some work in DRC previously, but as it turns out, there's not a lot of work done on conflict-related sexual violence, specifically relating to stigma and the issues around that. I think it's still a relatively new thing. So we had a bit of a brainstorm, and as I mentioned, you know, we've drawn on some of the previous research on stigma. We wanted to do some background work to better understand this issue specifically, and that brought us to decide to do a qualitative sandwich, which is basically where we used qualitative research, key informant interviews, focus groups to inform a survey, conducted a survey, and then closed by bringing the results of the survey back to the communities and saying, you tell us what's happening here. We see an association between this factor and this outcome. Can you tell us about the mechanism that's related in that association? And so that's how we're trying to unpack some of these things that have not been especially well investigated before. We also heavily informed the work by talking to service providers who, along with the women who experienced rejection, are, you know, very much the experts in the issue. And we ended up, after quite a few literature searches, finding that there's just not that much information out there on this issue, ended up turning to the HIV literature because there actually are some very interesting measures and very interesting work done on HIV-related stigma. So we tried to find some parallels there. The point where we are at now is that we started with our focus groups. Those have been completed and those results have been analyzed. That's fed into the creation of a survey, which we've just finished administering this summer. And we would like to bring these results back now in January of 2012 and present those to the community and have them explain it. So again, I appreciate your patience since this is a new project. We made a list of possible contributing factors that should be addressed, and you know, I think we can just so you guys know kind of where our investigations took us. A lot of it really is what we saw in the model in Jordan. I think a lot of it is relatively what you would expect in some ways. Okay, so this is one of our counselors who's a psychosocial assistant presenting the survey to a woman. The surveyors were men, but the reason that that happened was because there are very few service providers in Eastern DRC, and we didn't feel comfortable doing the work without providing referrals and psychological support. So we worked through the local partner who's already been embedded in these communities, often for almost a decade. And so while the service providers are men, they're often already known and highly trusted. And this was, again, reaching out through their network of women that they were helping, so women who'd already talked about and disclosed the fact that they were survivors of violence. Very preliminary survey results. About 40% of women noted that they either left their house or had a family member leave because of the sexual violence. So one thing that we saw is sometimes the husband would just disappear, so that's a different kind of rejection. And about 62% of women said that their financial control in the house was diminished after the attack. 70% of women said that they stopped going to farm because of shame related to rape. And again, we really tried to unpack this notion of, well, were you actually afraid of being attacked again if you went out into the field or if you went out alone? And it's actually, believe it or not, it's not fear of being attacked again. It's actual intense shame associated with being seen out in public after everyone knows what has happened to you. And these are extraordinarily hard scrabble subsistence culture. So if you can imagine, a woman actually stops going to farm, that has a lot of impacts for the house. 12% of women report being beaten in their homes before rape, 18 after, 20% of women reported verbal abuse in the home before the rape, and 60% reported that kind of abuse after. 60% said they felt like they lost status in their homes after the rape. And 66% they thought they lost status in the community after rape. There were significant relationships between rejection and whether a woman was actually abducted from the place of attack and held in the forest. As you would imagine, a lot of times if women are abducted, they can spend up to months or years away from their communities, and that kind of outsidership really feeds into the way that they're treated when they return back home. Rejection and getting injured or becoming sick as a result of rape was extraordinarily important. So if women can no longer be kind of perceived as productive members of the household, that means oftentimes the man justifies the rejection by saying, you know, I need a woman who can farm, I need a woman who can cook the food and who can take care of young children. And rejection and being currently displaced. So we see a lot of disruption of social cohesion and stable communities, and that really feeds into the sense of our community is already so destabilized and so kind of living on the edge that we just can't accommodate more vulnerable, sick, injured, traumatized members. And that definitely fed into the fact that women experienced rejection. What was interesting, and I should have probably made a bit more clear at the beginning, is that we surveyed both women and men in the same household, and so can actually compare perceptions, attitudes, and experiences within household units. So what we saw before was some of women's reported experiences, and now we can also hear kind of the primary male head of household's experience with the rejection. As you can imagine, it took quite a bit of effort to track down the men who did reject, right? So in the families that are kind of reunited, the man and the women are still together, we can often find two members of those households. The really hard part came in tracking down the men who actually had disassociated from their wives. And we were able actually to find some of those men, and it was interesting to say the male service providers would kind of go out in the middle of nowhere and try to track these guys down. And they said, you know, it was a very, very challenging process, and they would also have a lot of trouble, you know, trying to present the survey and why we were asking these questions, but we did have some success, which was quite interesting. Men's had a lot to say about the phenomena of sexual violence, stigmatization, and rejection. They really felt like they wanted to present their side of the story, mostly in the qualitative work, but to some extent in the quantitative work as well. There was this extraordinarily overwhelming fear of STIs and specifically HIV that came out again and again and again. And this really, really feeds into women's risk of being rejected. Men also state that they felt extraordinarily stigmatized, helpless, and demasculated if a woman in their household had been raped. And rape challenges men's understanding of marriage and fidelity. And this is actually quite interesting because in previous qualitative work in DRC, we find that there's actually very little distinction sometimes made between rape and adultery. So you kind of take away that aspect of the fact that it wasn't the woman's choice. And so what men often say is, look, marriage is about one woman, one man. If she's with someone else, it's not a marriage anymore. And so to challenge those kind of thoughts and assumptions through qualitative work or through community messaging might be very effective. Sorry for all the words, guys. I do apologize. Often there are kind of comorbidities of violence in DRC. So sexual violence is very, very often associated with catastrophic losses to the household. So that often means the house will be pillaged and then burnt during the attack or during a rape. And so that leaves the household in a very precarious situation. And if you're trying to rebuild everything, sometimes men just say, you know, we want to start afresh, new marriage, new household, new everything. The trauma men experience as a result of the rape and the associated violence they sometimes experience often was a foundational factor in whether men decide to reject that female family member or not. What we actually heard in a lot of the qualitative work that was that men said, you know, I just couldn't look at her anymore. I was so ashamed that I couldn't protect her and so traumatized that, you know, every time I saw her face, I remembered this attack. And often in DRC, rape is highly public and family members are forced to watch or hold a woman down. And men said that they just couldn't engage with the woman after this was over. And I think what we really see is a desperate need for better mental health services, because I think men just don't have the tools to start reaching out and rebuilding a relationship in the way that they feel like they should. But there's also protective factors and acceptance of survivors. Remember that 70%, right? So rejection stigmatization does not always happen in a household, and what we should do is try to find out what are those protective factors that we can then build upon. So love and affection and a history of a shared, a shared life together can really contribute to trying to support survivors after rape. The presence of children in the household, so especially young children, it's very important to keep a woman there to help keep the family together. And often, you know, if she's nursing, it's the man can't take care of the young children by himself. And persuasion from people of influence, including reconciliation counseling from NGOs. So some people kind of do marriage counseling, or, you know, village leaders or religious leaders can come in and talk about the importance of rebuilding your home together. And so I think what we see now is some opportunities for possible intervention or possible recommendations that we can make to start addressing the issue of stigmatization and rejection. So increasing public education campaigns around STIs and HIV, STIs including HIV. So what we did see often is that women said, you know, if I come back with a certificate from the hospital with a clean bill of health that after the rape I haven't contracted diseases, my husband is often much, much more likely to accept me back into the home. That's extraordinarily practical, but problematic as well, right? So, the first thing that I think of is it doesn't matter if she has diseases or not. She should be supported no matter what. And then even more problematic if she actually did contract HIV or an STI from the attack. And so how do you possibly engage with that issue but in a responsible way that doesn't then stigmatize the women who test positive? So that's a challenging moral ground to tread. Engaging people of influence to shift community attitudes around sexual violence. I know this sounds, kind of obvious and what have you, but what we did hear from a lot of religious leaders that we talked to were these kind of insidiously stigmatizing attitudes that crept into the way that they talked about survivors of sexual violence. So they would say, you know, we do understand it's not a woman's fault if she's raped, but, you know, the Bible says one woman, one man, and we just, you know, we can't tell a husband to keep a woman if she's been raped. And so it sounds obvious, but there's actually a lot of work to be done here, and there's a lot of ways to change attitudes in very concrete ways. Because I do think those religious leaders are trying to do what they think is right, but I think there's room for more positive messaging there, for sure. A lot of it is about community attitudes. So changing the way community structures think and talk about sexual violence survivors and stigma. What we heard from men in the surveys was very clearly, we said, you know, did you feel like people encouraged you to stigmatize your wife after rape, or some people encouraged you to accept her after rape? And we heard that a lot of times men kind of wanted to rebuild their lives, but their mothers or fathers or brothers or cousins or peers would say, you know, look, you should just start over. And that actually pushed them to do something that they might not otherwise have done. And really, the mental health aspect, I can't emphasize how extraordinarily important this is, that I think people, both clearly the women but also the men to some extent, need the mental health resources to cope with the kind of extraordinarily deep and intense trauma that they've undergone. And especially if that counseling can be done individually, and then, you know, as a family group or as a couple, I think that could be very, very powerful. So please stay tuned. Thank you for accommodating a study that is very much ongoing, and I very much look forward to your feedback. Thank you.